You're listening to an episode of a Wondery Plus exclusive series. To continue listening, join Wondery Plus and enjoy ad-free listening to over 40,000 episodes, early access to your favorite podcasts, and more. Find Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Boston, 1947, just past midnight. At a small research hospital, three trainee surgeons wheel a comatose patient down a deserted, dimly lit hallway. They're dressed in blue surgical scrubs and keep their voices low. One of the surgeons whispers to their leader, a handsome 30-year-old named David Hume.
Are you sure we can't do this in the OR?
Not unless you want your residency revoked.
Hume is a rising star here at the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital. Usually he's bold, cocky, but not tonight. Tonight he can barely keep his hands from shaking as he carries a kidney in a metal tray. The organ is small, no bigger than a pear. Such a tiny thing to risk his entire career on. But Hume's ambitions outweigh his fears. Tonight he wants to try an experimental treatment, one that's never been attempted. Tonight he wants to perform a kidney transplant. Hardly anyone else in the hospital knows what Hume and his fellow surgeons are up to, because if word got out, they could lose their residencies. Brigham Hospital might even be censured by the American Medical Association. Many doctors consider organ transplants to be highly unethical. Taking tissue from the dead and attaching it to the living? To many, that's not surgery. That's playing God.
Hurry up, her pulse rate is dropping.
Keep your voice down.
Their patient is a 29-year-old woman in the final stages of acute renal failure. Her kidneys are shutting down, no longer producing urine. As a result, she's dying. No treatment exists for her condition, so hospital administrators have classified her as terminal. This means no access to an operating room. Those are reserved for patients who might actually survive. Instead, they wheel their patient into a vacant storeroom. It's dark. The only lights are two gooseneck lamps with 60-watt bulbs. As Hume preps the patient with a local anesthetic, the other surgeons try to position the lights for maximum illumination.
Is that enough light for you to work by? It'll have to be. You guys ready? Yeah, let's get started.
It's an inauspicious setting for such an important moment in medical history. But over the next several hours, Hume and his colleagues perform what could be considered the world's first human kidney transplant. By design, the transplant is only temporary, just meant to interrupt the patient's renal failure, which was brought on by septic shock following an illegal, unsterile abortion. They don't even implant the kidney inside the patient's abdomen. Instead, they attach it to two blood vessels in her arm and wrap it against her elbow with sterile rubber sheeting. It's all a bit makeshift, but...
David, look, it's working.
Poking out from under the sheeting is the ureter, the tube that normally carries urine from the kidney to the bladder. As they watch, a few drops of clear yellow liquid drip from its tip. Then the drips become a steady trickle. Hume places a metal tray under the ureter to catch the drips. One of the surgeons lets out a whoop.
Woohoo!
We did it! We just did a kidney transplant.
Oh, yes! That's amazing!
Hume smiles and lets his fellow surgeons clap him on the back. But he knows this is only the beginning. What they've done is really just proof of concept. They now know that a kidney taken from one patient will function when grafted onto the body of another. But for how long? Could such a transplant be made permanent? And what about the other organs, liver, lungs, intestines, even the heart? Could they be transplanted too? Whatever happens next, Hume is determined to be the first surgeon ever to perform a successful long-term organ transplant. And he's not alone. All around the world, many other ambitious young surgeons are also beginning to experiment with transplantation. And their experiments will transform modern medicine in ways not even a visionary like David Hume could foresee.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Wondery, I'm Stephen Johnson, and this is American Innovations. David Hume's 1947 experiment in kidney transplantation was only a modest success. The transplanted kidney only functioned for a few days before shutting down. After Hume and his team removed it, their patient appeared to recover, but a few months later, she died. But Hume's experiment, and others like it, started a revolution. Today, organ and tissue transplantation are commonplace in surgical practice. Last year, more than 36,000 organ transplants were performed in the United States alone. Every day, at hundreds of hospitals around the country, patients receive new hearts, lungs, livers, and kidneys. Most of those patients go on to lead healthy lives with their new organs for years, even decades. But less than a century ago, organ transplants were the stuff of science fiction. Early transplant experiments were often dismissed as Frankenstein-like monstrosities that grafted the tissue of the dead onto the living. Myths surrounded the very concept of transplants. Stories of grave-robbing surgeons and law-abiding patients turned murderous after receiving new body parts from the corpses of executed criminals. These stories weren't true, but they were widespread enough in the early 20th century that the mainstream medical community kept its distance from organ transplant research. But a handful of experimental surgeons pressed on. By the early 1950s, they had begun to make headway. They were driven to save lives, but also by ego, by their desire to be first. A few would go on to achieve international fame. One would win the Nobel Prize for Medicine. Others would become famous only within the surgical community. Organ transplantation is an extremely complex process, and advances in the field were made by dozens of surgeons, physicians, and immunologists working over many decades. This series focuses on a select few of those individuals to tell the larger story of how organ transplants went from the radical fringes of medicine to the mainstream. This is Episode 1, The Kidney Twins. It's 1951, 4 years after David Hume's first attempt at a temporary kidney transplant. By now, Hume's research is fully sanctioned by the higher-ups at Brigham Hospital and its sister institution, Harvard Medical School. But he still hasn't been allowed to attempt another kidney transplant on a human subject. Not yet. For now, all of Hume's patients are dogs.
Welcome to the dog lab. This is where you'll be working.
At Harvard Surgical Research Lab, Hume gives a tour to the newest member of his team, a young surgeon named Joseph Murray. Murray is 31, younger than Hume, but with his thinning hair and wire-rimmed glasses, he seems older. Murray's an Army veteran. He left a promising career in plastic surgery to join Hume's transplant team, eager for a new challenge in cutting-edge medicine. But at the sight of all the dogs lined up in their cages, he looks nonplussed.
So, I'll be operating on dogs? Well, initially, yes. They're very important for our research. Here, let me show you.
Hume leads Murray down a row of cages. Hume got his surgical training in the Navy and still carries himself like a military officer, straight back, with a purposeful stride. But underneath that, he's full of boyish enthusiasm. Murray heard all the nurses have a crush on Hume, and now he can see why. They come to a cage, occupied by a brown beagle terrier mix. Its haunches are covered in surgical tape. The dog wags its tail happily as Hume reaches through the bars of the cage to scratch its head.
This is Charlie. 6 weeks ago, we removed one of his kidneys and grafted it back into his upper thigh. As you can see, he's doing quite well. We've got a few others who've survived even longer. Have you attempted any transplants between two dogs?
We have, but their survival rate is very low. They nearly all reject the organ after just a few days. Until we can figure out how to overcome the immune response, we want to perfect the surgical technique first.
And kill fewer dogs, I hope.
Yes, of course, that's the hope. The staff and students here treat them like pets. We try to avoid letting any of them suffer unnecessarily for the sake of our research.
In 1951, animal research labs like this one are common. Dogs are popular test subjects because they're easily trained and easily obtained from animal shelters. Murray, like most surgeons of his day, views experimenting on them as a necessary evil. Better to sacrifice a dog than a human patient for the sake of advancing medical science. Still, he's not looking forward to operating on them.
I have to admit, Dr. Hume, I prefer patients who can comprehend what's being done to them.
Now, I understand, but just think of what we're doing here. If we can perform the first successful human kidney transplant, we'll make history.
Well, if you can promise me I'll eventually get to operate on human patients, I'm in.
While Murray experiments in the dog lab, Hume finally gets the go-ahead to perform more human kidney transplants, but only in highly select cases where the patient is near death and no other treatment options exist. Over the next 2 years, he transplants new kidneys, all harvested from cadavers, into 8 patients. But each time, the procedure is a failure. The immune response attacks the new kidney like it's a foreign invader, and the patient dies, usually after just a few weeks. Hume and his team try antibiotics, cortisone, even testosterone to prevent organ rejection, but nothing works. Hume's superiors are supportive of his work. Still, he knows that he could be shut down any day. Even at a research hospital like Brigham, a survival rate of 0 is unsustainable. Hume needs a little luck. And finally, with his 9th patient, he gets some. The patient is a 26-year-old doctor from South America. To protect his privacy, Hume and the hospital staff refer to him only as Patient W. He's admitted with an inflammation of the kidneys that can lead to fatally high blood pressure. On February 11, 1953, Hume gives Patient W a kidney transplant. At first, things don't look good. A blood clot forms around the new kidney. It doesn't produce any urine. Then, 3 weeks after the surgery, something changes. On a cold, blustery morning in early March, Hume enters Patient W's room to find a familiar figure checking his blood pressure, the head of Brigham's kidney treatment program, John Merrill. Merrill is no great fan of Hume's transplant experiments. He prefers to treat kidney patients with a relatively new medical device, the dialysis machine. It doesn't cure kidney disease, but in most cases, it keeps the patient alive, which is more than he can say for Hume. But today, Merrill greets Hume with a grudging smile.
Well, your patient's condition seems to be improving. His blood pressure is still high, but it's much lower than it was yesterday. And the new kidney, well, see for yourself.
Gently, Hume pulls back a flap of skin on Patient W's thigh. Under it, wrapped in a clear bag, is the transplanted kidney. Hume prefers to implant kidneys here rather than in the abdomen because it's a simpler procedure and it gives him easier access to the organ post-surgery. A few days ago, the transplanted kidney was showing all the usual signs of rejection. Inflammation, a bruised brownish-gray color, lack of urine production. But today, it's a healthy shade of pink. Hume closes the skin flap and checks the urine collection bag.
400 milliliters? Is this just since this morning?
Yep, he's not out of the woods yet, but I have to admit, this looks promising.
2 months later, Patient W walks out of Brigham Hospital.
A bit awkwardly. After all, he has an extra kidney sewn into his thigh and a urine collection bag strapped to his hip.
but he's upright and healthy. He's the first patient ever discharged from a hospital with a fully functioning transplanted kidney. In the Brigham Hospital lobby, Dr. Hume comes to send him off. As patient W shakes his hand, there are tears in his eyes.
Thank you, doctor. Thank you for saving my life. Thank you for letting me save it. Don't forget, you have a follow-up appointment in a few weeks. Of course. I'll see you then.
As Hume turns to get back to his other patients, he sees Dr. Merrill waiting for him.
So, David, what do you think? Any idea why this guy lived and all your other patients didn't? Well, the donor was a compatible blood type, and wrapping the kidney in plastic might have suppressed the immune response. But honestly, I'm still not sure. Well, you'd better figure it out soon. One success out of 9 won't be enough to keep your transplant program going, especially if you can't explain the one success.
A few days later, in the dog lab, Joseph Murray also challenges Hume.
I'm telling you, David, we're getting much better results placing kidneys directly into the abdominal cavity. But once the cavity is sewn up, there's no way to directly observe how the kidney is doing. What's there to observe? I mean, so long as urine output is consistent, that's all we need to know.
Murray and Hume have been having this argument for months. But today, Hume cuts it short.
Well, pretty soon it won't matter what I think. You're going to be put in charge of the human transplant trials. What? Why? The Navy's called me back into active service. They're shipping me off to Korea. Oh, David, I'm so sorry. Me too. But look, I know we've had our differences, but you're a brilliant surgeon. I know I'm leaving the transplant program in good hands.
Privately, Hume is devastated. He was so close to perfecting human kidney transplants. Now he'll have to watch from the sidelines as Murray builds on his work. Then, in August of 1953, Hume gets more bad news. Patient W is dead. He survived with his transplanted kidney for nearly 6 months, far longer than any other transplant patient in history. But ultimately, his new organ failed. Back at Brigham, Murray wants to shake things up. He goes to the hospital's head of surgery, Dr. Francis Moore, to plead his case.
Look, I don't want to badmouth my predecessor, but all 9 of his transplant patients are dead. It's time we tried new techniques. What do you have in mind? First, we've got to try implanting the kidney into the abdomen instead of the thigh. We've got dogs with abdominal transplants who have survived for years in some cases. The dogs you operate on are healthy. All our transplant patients are dying. What if they're too weak to survive a major surgery? Oh, we won't know until we try. What we do know is that Hume's thigh transplants were prone to infection and blood clots, all kinds of complications. Fine. We'll try it your way.
Moore turns to leave.
Oh, one more thing. I think we need to start using live donors. The survival rate with cadaver kidneys is much lower.
In 1953, this is a radical proposal. No one in the United States has ever taken a kidney from a live human donor. A surgeon in Paris attempted it a few months earlier when a mother offered up her kidney to save her dying son. But the son died anyway, and many in the medical community criticized the surgeon for risking the mother's life too. Moore doesn't want that kind of criticism coming down on his hospital.
Live donors? Not a chance. But there are no known health risks to living with just one kidney. Look, Dr. Murray, our transplant program is controversial enough as it is. If we start using live donors, I don't think Brigham or Harvard will continue to support your research. But in the dog lab,
You're not in the dog lab anymore, Dr. Murray. We're talking about human beings. I'm sorry, but the answer is no. Over the next year, Murray performs another 6 kidney transplants using organs harvested from cadavers. As promised, he places them in the abdominal cavity, not in the kidney's normal position, but lower, closer to the bladder, in an area easier to operate on. At first, the results are promising. Murray's patients seem to recover faster than Hume's, with fewer post-surgery complications. But then, organ rejection sets in. And just as before, one by one, all the patients die. It's summer 1954. After losing yet another patient, Murray sits in the office of Brigham's head of kidney medicine, John Merrill. Murray's blurry-eyed from the lack of sleep. He fought for days to save this last patient, to no avail. Now he looks shell-shocked. He hasn't even changed out of his white doctor's coat, which is still streaked with traces of the patient's vomit. Murray and Merrill often disagree about how best to treat their patients, but despite that, they've become good friends. Merrill offers the exhausted Murray a cigarette. He lights up and takes a long drag.
I don't know how much more of this I can take, John. We're getting nowhere. Maybe it's time to float the idea of live donors again. Maybe, but the bigger issue is organ rejection. If we can't break the barrier of the immune response, we're just wasting time and patients' lives.
Murray takes a long drag on his cigarette, thinking.
But what if we could bypass the immune response entirely? What do you mean? When I was treating burn victims in my plastic surgery days, there was some promising research into skin grafting between identical twins. It turns out that if two patients have the same DNA, they can exchange tissue without rejection. Yeah, that makes sense. But where are we going to find a pair of identical twins in which only one twin has kidney disease? I don't know. But let's put the word out to other hospitals. Maybe some will turn up.
It's a long shot. But the more Murray thinks about it, the more he's convinced that it just might work. Now, all he has to do is find the right pair of twins, which is easier said than done. Identical twins make up less than 1% of the population, and finding a pair in which one sibling has healthy kidneys and the other doesn't will be even more elusive. But Murray is willing to wait for as long as it takes. He's sure that once he can find his identical twins, he'll be able to make medical history. Imagine you're trying to achieve something, and it would take you 50 years to do it. Now imagine you could achieve the same thing in just 4 months. Isn't that better? Let's say you have $20,000. With typical banks, it would take you 50 years to earn the same amount of interest. It will take you just 4 months to earn with Wealthfront. With the Wealthfront cash account, you earn more interest on your money. They have one of the highest interest rates in the market at 1.78% annual percentage yield. That's 19 times more interest than the national average of 0.09%, according to FDIC.gov. It only takes $1 and a few minutes to open an account. You can even do it right from your phone, no paperwork required. Right now, you can sign up for the Wealthfront cash account in less than 5 minutes by visiting wealthfront.com/AI. That's wealthfront.com/AI to start earning 19 times more interest on all your savings. One more time, wealthfront.com/AI. Wealthfront is not a bank. Cash account is offered by Wealthfront Brokerage, LLC, member of FINRA SIPC. Wealthfront conveys funds to partner banks who accept and maintain deposits, provide the interest rate, and provide FDIC insurance. The APY is subject to change. It's October 26, 1954. At the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital in Boston, an ambulance arrives carrying a very special patient, transferred from another hospital. His name is Richard Herrick, a 23-year-old Coast Guard veteran from the nearby town of Northborough. He's dying of acute kidney failure, a complication from having had scarlet fever as a child. And he has an identical twin brother, one who never had scarlet fever and so has healthy kidneys. Richard Herrick is exactly the kind of patient Dr. Joseph Murray has been waiting for.
Hold him down. Where are those restraints?
There's just one problem. The toxins flooding his bloodstream have made him delirious. Violently so.
You bastard, let me go!
Did you administer that sedative?
Yes, on the way here.
Well, you better give him another one. The EMTs, nurses, and orderlies wrestle their new patient to the kidney ward, where Murray and Dr. John Merrill are waiting for him. As the staff straps Herrick into a bed, he curses and thrashes around. His hands and feet are puffy from hypertension, and his skin is turning a sickly orange color. He smells of ammonia. The toxins that his body would normally slough off through urine are leaking out of his sweat glands. Murray turns to Merrill and shakes his head.
Even once he's sedated, I can't perform a transplant on this man. I mean, he's too far gone.
We'll put him on dialysis and take him off the meds the other hospital had him on. They're probably adding to his delirium.
Well, if his condition improves, call me. I'll see if I can arrange a meeting with the brother.
A few days later, Richard Herrick's twin brother, Ronald, and his sister, Virginia, sit across from Merrill and Murray in Merrill's office. Ronald's resemblance to Richard is uncanny. Same square jaw, dark hair, wide-set eyes. He listens intently as Murray describes the transplant procedure. When Murray's finished, Ronald looks a bit stunned. Merrill clears his throat.
I'm sure you must have questions. Will it work? Will it save his life?
Now Murray speaks up.
We can't guarantee anything, but it's his best chance. Then I'm in. Let's do it.
But Virginia, the sister, isn't convinced.
Hold on a minute. What happens to Ron after he gives Richard his kidney? How will that affect his health? Very little, as far as we know. There are many thousands of known cases of people born with one kidney or who have to have one surgically removed, and their life expectancy is the same as if they had two.
Ronald takes his sister's hand.
Look, Virginia, I know it's risky, but Richard would do the same for me if our positions were reversed. I've got to do it.
Murray and Merrill exchange glances, trying to hide their excitement. It's important for ethical reasons that they do nothing to pressure or influence Ronald in any way. He's got to make this decision entirely on his own. Murray looks at Ronald as calmly as possible.
You're a brave young man, Mr. Herrick. If you're sure you want to proceed, there are some release forms we'll need you to sign. And we'll need to conduct some tests.
What kind of tests?
We need to make sure you and Richard really are identical twins.
Well, of course we are. Just look at us.
We can't determine that from looks alone. Some fraternal twins appear to be virtually identical. And if you and Richard don't share the exact same DNA, well, there's a chance his body could reject your kidney.
I see. Okay. So what do I have to do?
Over the next several days, Murray and his team study the Herrick twins down to the last detail. They compare their blood types, the shapes of their ears, the pigmentation patterns in their irises. They also conduct a skin graft, transferring a tiny patch of skin from Ronald's arm onto Richard's. A few weeks later, when Richard's body still hasn't rejected the graft, Murray is convinced that the twins are identical. But Merrill still isn't quite ready to sign off.
What about fingerprints? Have we compared those? We don't have the necessary equipment here. Then send them to a police station. I'm sure they'd be happy to help.
John, you're being ridiculous. The skin graft is proof enough. If we get this wrong, we may never get another chance. Don't you think we should exhaust every possible test for matching DNA?
Fine. The police station it is.
On a cold afternoon in December, the Herrick twins arrive at the Roxbury Crossing Police Station in Boston. Richard is still very sick, so Ronald pushes him in a wheelchair up to the dispatch officer at the front desk.
We're here to see Detective Black.
As they're waiting in the lobby, a man in a scruffy gray trench coat approaches the twins. A lanyard around his neck says, "Press."
What brings you boys in today? Reporting a crime? Oh, no, nothing like that. Brigham Hospital sent us here to get fingerprinted. They need to make sure we're identical twins so I can give them my kidney.
As Ronald explains the transplant procedure, the reporter's eyes light up. He takes out a slim notebook and begins furiously jotting down notes.
What did you say your names were?
The next morning, when Joseph Murray grabs the newspaper off his front porch, a headline on the bottom of the front page catches his eye. Twins' life may hang on a fingerprint. When he arrives at the hospital that morning, the main lobby is swarming with reporters. Somehow, a few of them already know what Murray looks like, and they rush him as soon as he enters.
Dr. Murray, can you tell us when the kidney transplant will take place? What is the sick twin's condition like right now? How do you know that the transplant will work? Sorry, gentlemen, you'll have to speak to someone in our public relations department.
Murray hurries past the reporters as they continue peppering him with questions. He ducks into an elevator and presses the button for his floor with a shaky hand. He's not used to dealing with the press. None of Brigham's previous kidney transplants were reported in mainstream media, but obviously that won't be the case this time. A lot was already riding on the Herrick twins. Now, with the press watching, the stakes will be even higher. The news from the police is good. 9 out of 10 of Richard's and Ronald's fingerprints share the same patterns. That, combined with all their other tests, is enough to convince John Merrill. He gives the green light. They can proceed with the transplant. But with all the increased public attention, Murray is having second thoughts, especially after an encounter with a particularly skeptical colleague who confronts him as they're rinsing off after another surgery.
Are you really sure you want to take a kidney from a healthy man, Joe? Well, what about our Hippocratic Oath? First, do no harm. If it's the only way to save the man's twin brother, I think it's worth it, don't you?
Not really. What happens if they both die? Your career will be over.
Murray isn't really worried about his career, but he does want to be sure he's doing the right thing. Over the next few weeks, he consults with every legal and ethical expert he can think of. He speaks to fellow surgeons, lawyers, clergymen. He asks all of them the same question. Is it worth risking one patient's life to save another's? Finally, one night, Murray tells Merrill that he's made up his mind. The transplant is the right thing to do.
What convinced you, Joe?
An old army buddy of mine. He pointed out that in combat, we're trained to lay down our lives if it means saving one of our own. If it's reasonable to do that, it's reasonable to give an organ, don't you think?
Murray's ethical misgivings are resolved, but he's still not quite ready to perform the surgery. First, he wants to do a practice run on a cadaver. In 1954, this is easier said than done. Very few people donate their bodies to medical science. Murray calls pathology departments all over town looking for a donor. It's December 20th, 1954, a cold, snowy evening. In his suburban Boston home, Joseph Murray whips up a batch of homemade eggnog. He and his wife Bobby are hosting a Christmas party tonight. Guests are due to start arriving any minute.
Hello? Oh, it's for you, honey.
Murray puts down the cognac and takes the receiver from his wife.
Hello? Really? Right now? Okay, I'll be there as soon as I can.
Murray hangs up and looks at his wife sheepishly.
That was the pathology department. They finally got me a cadaver. I have to go in.
As a surgeon's wife, Bobby is used to her husband's erratic schedule. She sighs and gives him a kiss on the cheek.
All right, go. I'll tell our guests you're off saving humanity.
Thanks, dear. Save me some eggnog.
An hour later, Murray stands over his cadaver in blue surgical scrubs. There to observe and assist is Brigham's head of surgery, Francis Moore. Moore knows how important this transplant will be to Brigham's reputation, and he wants to keep a close eye on everything Murray does leading up to it. Carefully, Murray slices open the cadaver's lower abdomen. He pushes aside the appendix and intestines, clearing a space for the transplanted kidney. Then he isolates the artery and vein that he'll redirect to bring blood to the new organ. Moore watches intently, just over his shoulder.
So you'll be using the iliac artery?
Yes, it's a slight variation on our previous intra-abdominal kidney transplants, but I think it'll increase our chance of success. I've done it many times on dogs, and the results have been good.
Murray works methodically, knowing he'll have to move faster on a live patient. He wants to get every step of the procedure just right. After about 2 hours, the new kidney is fully connected to its new bladder and blood vessels. Murray steps back so Moore can examine his work.
Nice job, Joe. So, you think you're ready for the real thing?
Yes, I'm ready.
The transplant surgery is set for Thursday, December 23rd. By now, it's a national news story. If Murray and his team succeed, they'll make medical history. If they fail, it could set the whole field of organ transplants back decades. According to ZipRecruiter research, nearly three-quarters of employers say they're finding it difficult to fill open positions. It's not for lack of trying. 68% of employers have raised their wages, and 23% have increased their benefits. The bottom line is, hiring is hard. If you have a difficult role to fill, no matter what your industry, ZipRecruiter can make it easier. And now you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/AI. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 top job sites. Then, with their powerful matching technology, they scan thousands of resumes to find people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invite them to apply. You can even add screening questions to your job listing so you can filter candidates and focus on the best ones. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
To try ZipRecruiter for free, listeners of American Innovations can go to ZipRecruiter.com/AI. That's ZipRecruiter.com/AI. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/AI. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Late nights at work taking a toll on your skin? Do you find yourself staring at those dark circles in the mirror? Well, it's time to meet your new best friend, Dark Circle Defense Balm from Lumen. Lumen is a line of brilliant men's skincare solutions crafted especially for men who want to look and feel their brightest. Whether you're a seasoned skincare pro or a total newbie, Lumen Skin has got you covered. Lumen's Dark Circle Defense Balm is a lightweight gel that absorbs seamlessly into your skin to brighten your under eyes and instantly plump dehydration lines. It's basically an espresso shot for your eyes. The best part? Lumen will let listeners of this podcast try the product out for free. Yes, you heard that right. Free. Head to lumenskin.com/wondery and get your free trial of Dark Circle Defense and their other amazing products now. Say goodbye to tired-looking eyes and say hello to a new and refreshed you. Don't wait any longer. Your skin will thank you. That's lumenskin.com/wondery for your free trial.
Brigham Hospital, December 23rd, 1954. In a brightly lit operating room, a team of surgeons in blue scrubs and masks surround Richard Herrick, who lies unconscious on the operating table. Tubes taped to his nose provide a steady stream of anesthetic gas. Bags of blood, saline, and more anesthesia dangle from a metal rack suspended over his head. Through an incision in Herrick's lower abdomen, Dr. Joseph Murray carefully isolates the blood vessels that will be connected to the donor kidney. Other surgeons hover on either side of him, ready with additional instruments.
Sponge, please. Sponge. Okay, tell them we're ready.
One of the support surgeons quickly leaves through the OR's swinging doors. He's heading to a second operating room just down the hall, where another surgical team stands ready to remove a kidney from Richard's twin brother, Ronald. Until that kidney is ready, all Murray and his team can do is wait. No one says a word. It's so quiet, they can hear the IV drip. Each minute that passes feels like an eternity. Finally, at 9:53 a.m., just 3 minutes later, the support surgeon returns along with Dr. Francis Moore. In a stainless steel basin, wrapped in a sterile wet cloth, Moore carries their prize, a healthy kidney freshly taken from Ronald Herrick. Gently, he sets the fist-sized organ down on a tray next to Richard's motionless body. Murray nods at Moore, then glances around at his team through his wire-rimmed glasses.
Okay, everyone, let's get to work.
Their first order of business is to get blood flowing to the new kidney. To do that, Murray must take the main artery and vein of Ronald's kidney and carefully stitch them to the artery and vein he's isolated in Richard's abdomen. It's the most challenging step in the entire transplant procedure, and it has to be done quickly. The longer the new kidney goes without blood supply, the greater the chance it will fail.
Clamps, please.
Murray cuts off the blood flow in the two vessels, then snips them, as delicately as a man diffusing a bomb. Then, just as delicately, he begins the laborious process of suturing them to the severed blood vessels on the donor kidney.
Sponge.
As Murray works, other surgeons occasionally reach in to sponge up excess blood or carefully reposition an organ. It's a delicate dance. One false move and Murray could irreparably damage a blood vessel, which would spell disaster. Finally, after more than an hour, Murray lifts his weary hands out of Richard's abdomen.
Ready? Remove the clamps.
This is the moment of truth. Once blood flow to the kidney is restored, they should be able to tell right away if it's working. Two assistant surgeons gently remove the clamps. The kidney puffs up slightly as it fills with fresh blood. Its color turns from dull gray to rosy pink. It's looking good. They still haven't completed the final step in the surgery, attaching the kidney's ureter to the bladder. For now, the ureter runs into a catheter tube that drains into a catch basin next to the operating table. As blood flow returns to the kidney, the catheter jerks to life. Urine splashes out of it into the basin. It's pale yellow and clear.
It's working! Dr. Murray, you've done it! Let's not get too excited yet. We've still got work to do.
As the ureter continues to splash urine, Murray removes it from the catheter
and attaches it to Herrick's bladder. Then, after one last check of the kidney and its blood vessels, he steps back.
Okay, let's close him up.
Under his surgical mask, Murray is grinning from ear to ear. He turns and sees his boss, Dr. Moore, who's been watching from the corner of the OR.
Excellent surgery, Joe. Congratulations.
Thanks.
Here's hoping it works.
It's January 29th, 1955. A big day for Richard Herrick and for the surgeons who saved his life. Today, Richard is being discharged from the Peter Bent Brigham Hospital.
Okay, buddy, lift up your butt.
As Richard balances on the edge of his hospital bed, his brother Ronald helps him put on his pants. Then he straightens Richard's tie and claps him on the shoulder.
You ready, buddy? As I'll ever be.
Richard lowers himself into a wheelchair. Though he's still weak, he looks much healthier than he did a month ago, before his surgery. His skin is no longer sallow, and he's put on some weight. As Ronald pushes him out the door, he grins up at his brother.
How many reporters did you say are out there? I can't count that high. Don't worry, though. You look great.
Before running through the gauntlet of reporters and photographers in the lobby, the brothers drop by Dr. Murray's office. Murray is waiting for them with the kidney program chief, John Merrill, and another surgeon, Hartwell Harrison, the man who removed Ronald's kidney. Harrison is the first to speak.
You're looking good, Ron. Feeling good, Doc. My scar doesn't even itch anymore. How about you, Richard? Ready to go home?
You bet I am.
My aunt promised me a steak dinner. I feel like I could eat 10 of them.
At this, Murray smiles.
That's great to hear, Richard. We'll see you in a couple of weeks for your follow-up.
Over the next several months, Richard Herrick's condition continues to improve. After some debate, Murray and Merrill decide to remove both his diseased kidneys, which appears to speed up his recovery even more. By November of 1955, Richard is leading a healthy, normal life. His new kidney is functioning well, with no sign of disease or rejection. He even has a new wife, a nurse he met at Brigham Hospital during his recovery. Richard Herrick goes down in history as the first successful kidney transplant recipient. His story makes headlines around the world. But within the medical community, the Herrick transplant is viewed mainly as a curiosity. Transplants may work for identical twins, but what about the other 99% of patients who don't have a potential donor with identical DNA? It's 1958, nearly 4 years after the Herrick transplant. By now, Murray and his team have performed another 6 kidney transplants between identical twins. But Murray is getting tired of repeating a procedure that benefits only a tiny sliver of the population. In Francis Moore's office, he vents his frustration.
We can't just keep operating on twins. I mean, what's the point? We need to demonstrate that kidney transplants can succeed long-term with a non-identical donor. But you've said it yourself, Joe. It's the immune response. We still can't overcome it. Not consistently, anyway. Till we figure that part out, it's not worth the risk. But to figure it out, we need human trials. I can't experiment on dogs forever. I'm sorry, Joe, but none of the existing techniques for suppressing immune response have shown enough promise. You need to keep looking for other solutions. There are no other solutions. Radiation, steroids, antibiotics, that's all we've got. Then we'll just have to wait.
And for now, that's all they can do. Wait. For organ transplants to continue, there will need to be new advances, not just in surgery, but in immunology. And for that, Murray will need help from an unexpected source. Despite its limitations, Murray's success with identical twin kidney transplants inspires others to enter this new field of cutting-edge surgery. They're experimenting not just with kidneys, but other organs, including the one held in the highest regard by both surgeons and the general public, the heart. On our next episode, a new drug promises to finally solve the riddle of organ rejection. And as more surgeons attempt even bolder organ transplants, some of their experiments get truly bizarre. I hope you enjoyed this episode of American Innovations. If you did, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One, and every major listening app, as well as at Wondery.com. If you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast. You'll find the episode notes, including some details you might have missed. You'll also find some offers from our sponsors. Please support our show by supporting them. And thank you. American Innovations is hosted by me, Stephen Johnson. For more information on my books about history and innovation, including my new one coming out in May, Enemy of All Mankind, you can visit my website, www.stephenberlinjohnson.com. Sound design on this episode is by Landon Lipinski. This episode is written by Andy Herman and edited by Audrey Dilling. Produced by Natalie Shisha. Executive produced by Jenny Lauer Beckman, Marshall Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.